believe them or not. But it is certainly possible that it could occur because of the difference in the capacity in which the institution was, or the FISLIC was acting in its corporate capacity and in its receivership capacity.
You just have to keep the money that you had previously agreed to pay to Mr. Dalton, is that correct?
We did. That's correct. Well, our position on that.
I'm wondering how vigorous your incentive was.
Well, actually, no, the incentive or the party who actually had the incentive to challenge that regulatory action was Mr. Dalton. He is the party who is aggrieved by this regulatory action that the federal government has taken. Our position vis-a-vis Mr. Dalton in this case has always been, we made a deal with Mr. Dalton, and absent the federal prohibition, we would have honored that deal. But we are not aggrieved. In fact, I doubt that we had any standing to pursue a challenge to regulatory action that ended up benefiting us to the extent of $750,000.
But the prohibition was invited. I mean, you could have backed out. Syntex could have said, "Oops, sorry, we've already got a deal and we got honored. We'll withdraw."
Well, again, I'm not certain that that's true, but I think the obvious fact is we did not back out. And the question then is, what is the effect of the regulatory action that the FISLIC in its corporate capacity took?
Well, and wouldn't you concede that a party cannot voluntarily contract to undertake one obligation and then turn around and voluntarily contract to undertake another obligation that prohibits the performance of the first one?
In general, that's correct. That is not what happened here.
Why not?
Because, again, what happened was that the FISLIC in its corporate capacity rejected the contract provision that we had made. And it's clear that that's what they undertook to do. If you read the transcript, it's of the telephone meeting that occurred on the evening before this transaction was approved. You can see the bank board, in fact, engaging in making a regulatory decision. They have looked at this. They understand that Syntex has made an agreement. In fact, the agreement was structured so that Syntex, rather than Texas Trust, would make the payment in order to comply with the indications that they previously received from the bank board officer in Chicago, that the payment would be acceptable so long as Syntex and not the institution made that payment.
What was the total dollar amount of consideration involved in the four SNLs and the land package?
I do not have that information, Your Honor. It's a number of millions of dollars. I simply don't know the figure. But it's reflected in the acquisition agreement.
Recognizing that you have attacked this summary judgment on a number of different grounds, if you were advising the court as to the best way to resolve this matter, given your early comments that it's controlled by federal law, would that advice be to resolve this question based on federal preemption rather than concluding that relying on the impossibility because of governmental action?
Well, I think there are three basic possibilities of it. We clearly have the federal government in its regulatory posture taking action that prohibits this payment. First question is, what is the substantive effect of that action on Mr. Dalton's state law claim? We've cited the restatement of contracts provision and the Motley case in our brief, that the effect of that is to render his contract unenforceable under Texas law because of the supervening governmental action after the contract was made. If that is not the result under Texas substantive law, then the situation is that you have a federal prohibition, federal law, federal authorities telling Syntex, do not make this payment because we as a matter of federal public policy, have looked at this specific payment, decided it is unacceptable, we don't want these finder's fees paid in these Southwest plan transactions. Then, in that circumstance, we can't comply with both. We can't comply with a state law contractual obligation to Mr. Dalton and not violate the federal prohibition against the payment and vice versa. Under well-established preemption principles at that point, and recognized under Texas law, as the court has recognized in its earlier decision, the result is again that Mr. Dalton has no enforceable claim because of federal preemption.
So if we, basically, if we conclude that you are right about the impossibility of performance, we don't have to reach the preemption question.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. The other question that is in this is the jurisdictional question.
Right.
It is the question of whether, because of the agency action, the effect of that, of Mr. Dalton's bringing his state law contract claim is to make a collateral attack upon the federal agency action, or to attempt to do that. And the Haar case and the others that we've cited in our brief indicated that circumstance. Once the agency made this decision on December 29, took this regulatory action, then that had the effect of depriving a state court of subject matter jurisdiction to adjudicate his contract claim, because the effect of that would be to collaterally attack the agency action.
Well, one other question. You do, of course, have a number of cases in your brief concerning the impossibility issue. One that I think is not there is a 1905 opinion from this court, Houston Ice and Brewing against Keenan. Are you familiar with that case?
I'm not familiar with the case.
If you review it subsequently, and I extend this invitation to opposing counsel also, and you think it's relevant, would you advise by letter brief?
Certainly we'll be happy to.
Thank you.
I'll reserve the rest of my time if there are no further questions.
Any other questions at this time? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Bernard Fishman will represent the respondent.
Police Court, Bernard Fishman of San Antonio, Fishman and House, before the respondent, John Dalton. In the largest sense, what this court has to decide in this case, first off, is this contract to be upheld? Is our contracts to be given credence in this state that are legal on their face, that have a valid objective, that are undisputed, that are in writing, and that were performed, at least in part, before any of the allegedly supervening legislation or rulings came down that might arguably have compromised this contract. In making that decision, I don't think, even though this is a summary judgment case and the case and the facts are essentially stipulated, if not absolutely agreed upon, In looking at that, and looking at those facts, I think it's important to recognize what really happened here and what's in this summary judgment record and what is not in the summary judgment record. Mr. Dalton was a former chairman of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. He had also, prior to that, been the president of the Government National Mortgage Association. He was then, at the time in 1988, an experienced executive of an admittedly failing savings and loan association that, like many others in Texas, was about to be compromised under the Southwest plan. He is part of his knowledge and abilities helped to arrange the transaction that made in response to one of the questions of the court. I think Justice Cook asked what was the total value of this package. It was in excess, I believe, of $150 million. And the purpose of these deals, they were assisted transactions, they got the net operating loss carry forwards, they got certain regulatory forbearances that are discussed, as a matter of fact, in our supplemental brief and an amicus brief, which the OTS filed in this case on Friday. all of those things combined to make this a very, very profitable deal for this billion-dollar-plus corporation. And I think that we can't get away from the fact that, as Justice Heck asked the question, aren't you really just trying to get out of your contract? You got, you know, could have paid this money if you wanted to, but you're not a very, you're not protesting very much that the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, or now the OTS, is out there saying you can't do this.
Well, I didn't know I suggested that they could have paid it if they wanted to. What I was curious about was, couldn't they back out of the closing? Do you think Syntex could have backed out of the closing?
Absolutely.
But that wouldn't have helped you.
Sir?
But that wouldn't have helped Mr. Dalton.
No, sir, it clearly would not have. But it was an express condition of the contract, and that's why this whole illegality argument fails.
But either way, you don't get paid.
Either way, we don't get paid. But they had a contractual obligation that pre-existed the obligation that came into effect subsequently.
But if they can't pay the money that they contracted to pay Mr. Dalton under any circumstances, either they don't close, they don't buy the properties, and they don't owe it, or they do close, the agency won't let them. One way or the other, they're not going. Mr. Dalton not going to get his money.
Well, that's right. But the way I perceive the court's question, it seemed to me that it's clear they haven't protested very much. They can't pay.
Would you protest very much? You know, that's quite a windfall.
Justice Gonzalez, I don't know how to answer that question. I mean, to me, they've told us all along, hey, a deal's a deal, and we'd love to help you, but I'll tell you what it's like. I mean, really, it sounds kind of silly, but I was thinking about this morning. My little six-year-old son has a book called The Gorilla Made Me Do It. It's a bedtime story. And in that book, every time this kid breaks a promise to his mommy, didn't, you know, ate too many cookies, didn't clean up his room or whatever, he says, the gorilla made me do it. So what they want us to do is to go attack that 900-pound gorilla. And what I'm telling this
And you know who wins that battle.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't have to take that bait for several reasons. Number one, the illegality argument fails for this reason. They contracted in advance with reference to the fact that this possibility, this supervening condition could arise, and there's not a word in this contract about it. Their own brief, my brief, the Court of Appeals opinion, and the stipulations of fact and the request for admissions all say that they knew before they signed the contract with Dalton on December the 23rd that this could be an issue, and they asked the board, can we do this? And they said, as long as it's Syntex paying and not the acquired associations or the new association that is to be formed, yes, it's all right.
What
so
board,
they knew
what board is that? They asked the board?
They asked the board.
What board?
The Federal Home Loan Bank of Dallas, actually. They asked the Dallas Bank, can we do this?
Well, are you saying that Syntex should have paid this to you voluntarily after telling the government they wouldn't, or that you should win? That Syntex has done nothing wrong so far except that you should win this lawsuit and then they should pay. I'm a little unclear on your position.
I'm not really sure I understand how to answer that question. I can tell you this. They can pay this money because a court has said they can pay this money, and this court has to decide is that correct or not.
But
if they do.
Up to the point of the trial court judgment, I was just wondering, sir, are you contending that Syntex should have paid this before then? Or?
Absolutely, and because it was not illegal to do so. And I want to make this point about what's in the summary judgment and what's not in the record, because it is important to determine that. First off, and we've been consistent about this in our briefs and even in a motion that I filed just to be sure I preserved the point as far as the writ being granted, the only copy of the resolution that's in this summary judgment record properly before the court is the one page. Just that one page. This whole 30-something page document is not in the record. There's no signature. There's no identifying information. There is no way to read this document out of context and know that it prohibits the payment of this fee. So on the summary judgment record before the court, clearly the trial court was correct, because you can't tell what this is talking about.
So are there other provisions that are significant to the issue? Are there other provisions of the entire document that are significant to the issue?
In this sense, yes, Your Honor, because how do you know who New Federal is? If you can find New Federal being defined on this one page, 35 of this resolution, then you may be able to answer that question.
And maybe there is some defect in the record. I don't know whether there is or not, but if it is just simply a matter of amending the record to put in the whole agreement, if there's no real dispute about what the rest of it shows or what the trial court would have done if he had it, what difference does it make?
Well, no one has ever sought leave to amend the record. I raised this point at oral argument on the motion for summary judgment, and the response was, well, gee, you didn't say anything in the plea. Bear in mind, this is an affirmative defense of illegality that Syntex is raising. They had the burden to plead and prove that, and that is clear under this court's decisions. In fact, they've cited the ERISA, the two ERISA cases, Kathy and Gorman. And in those cases, you held that ERISA preemption is an affirmative defense which is subject to waiver. And I would submit to the court that if that can be waived in that context, it can be waived in the context of keeping your summary judgment record correct. Now, if I'm wrong about that.
I want to be sure I understand you correctly. There is nothing articulating this prohibition in the summary judgment record.
That is exactly my position.
They did not plead this affirmative defense. They put on no proof of this affirmative defense.
They pleaded the affirmative defense. They attached an affidavit of David Quinn, the executive vice president, who said, attached to my affidavit is a true and correct copy of the resolution of the board.
Which does not allude to the prohibition.
No, it does, Your Honor. It has the paragraph 21 that is that. But what I'm saying is, read paragraph 21. Let me read it to the court. No advisory fees, finder's fees, investment banker's fees, or other fees incurred in connection with the acquisition shall be paid directly or indirectly by the New Federal. The terms New Federal are not defined anywhere in this document.
Are they defined in the accompanying affidavit or any other summary judgment proof?
To the best of my recollection, not.
Well, specifically, what about the meeting of December the 29th? Is that part of the record?
Yes, I believe that is part of the record because they put a full transcript of it, they swore the truth of it, and they had a certificate that it was, in the same sense that we've had those cases out of the Dallas court, I think, that say that you have to go through a certain procedure now to authenticate a deposition.
Right.
All right. I think they got it right there.
Well, when you take that December 29th minute and you compare it with the one from January 31st, isn't it pretty clear what happened here?
I can only answer that by reference to the fact of what I know from having read the entire resolution and having read the amendatory resolution as well. That brings me to the other critical point about the facts of this case that I think is inescapable. On December 29th of 1988, when the transaction closed, there was, in fact, no prohibition on payment of the fee to Dalton.
Well, at that point, had Mr. Dalton fully performed?
That's a kind of a yes and a no. Yes, he had performed all services in connection with the acquisition because the acquisition was completed. The remainder of
he had not performed all that he had contracted to perform, though, for the $750,000 fee.
For the first $300,000, he arguably had done everything he was supposed to do by that day. The remaining $450,000 was to be paid out over a three-year term in which he was to be a consultant. And, I mean, there's some implication here that there's something cheesy about that deal. Mr. Dalton, as I said, was a very able and experienced savings and loan executive, and who, with the financial backing of a company like Syntex, as a consultant, using his knowledge and expertise as a former chairman of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, yes, he would have been a valuable consultant to them. So it is, idle speculation to assume that he wasn't going to do anything for the remainder of that money.
But for whatever reason, the agency didn't want the fee to be paid. Query, could the agency have issued the consent decree that is now in effect if it had not included the resolution in the closing document?
I would suggest to the court not. I'm not fully briefed on the point, but I will submit to you that the Lynch case that we cite in our brief would say they could not, because that is, in effect, a subsequent invalidation of a valid, vested, matured contract right. And I've not read any cases that say they can do that. Now, I'll say this. In our supplemental brief, we point out that that's a real hot issue because of Section 401G of FIREA, which is now making its way through the federal courts, even as we speak. There's literally several dozen cases where the ability of the regulatory authorities to abrogate a contract and just destroy a contract right is now at issue. But FIREA wasn't enacted until August of 89, and I think that in Syntex's brief and in the OTS brief, that power is, especially in the OTS brief, is misrepresented. That power did not exist under the statutory law in December 88 or even January 89.
In your brief, you characterize the attachment of these minutes of the meeting of December 29th as meaningless. But isn't it meaningful to know that the bank board at that time, on the 29th, expressed concern about the perception of these deals being brokered?
I think it's meaningful in the sense of understanding the policy and the thoughts that were in the minds of the regulatory authorities. I mean, you can see what was going on there, that there were some concerns. And even some of the regulatory authorities even came to Mr. Dalton's defense and said, well, now, let's not go too far with this. But the reason I characterize the minutes as meaningless is because of the things I've already said to this point. Number one, that the resolution itself, by their own recognition, if you look at transcript 118 and transcript 120, and in that is the pages where this meeting transcript appeared in your record in this court, they said, Mr. Barkley, George Barkley was the president of the Dallas Bank at the time, he said, we would prefer a minute entry because we are uncertain if the provisions you have read apply to the holding company, to Syntex, where the fee would be paid. He himself didn't think it expressed it. And
this is at the January 31st meeting?
No, this is the December 29th meeting. And that's why I say on December the 29th, when this deal closed, there was, even if you give credence to this resolution, you say it's properly before the court on the summary judgment record, it didn't prohibit Syntex from doing anything. And when they breached and failed to pay the $300,000 that had been earned on that date, both in the sense of the contract itself and in the substantive performance that the acquisition was completed, they breached the entire contract. And the entire remaining indebtedness matured as of that point. And that is not before the court. The court did not grant the point of error on that. And it's adequately briefed both in our brief and by the opinion of the Court of Appeals.
Why doesn't the issuance of the consent decree indicate that the agency thought that the resolution did prohibit Syntex from paying the fee?
Again, Justice Heck, I don't know how to delve into the minds of the OTS. They have a policy that they've got a point of view that they're intent on imposing in this transaction on the Texas courts. And I might tell you this, in their brief, their amicus brief, and on the telephone on Friday, they made it very clear that they don't care what this court says about this. If this court upholds our summary judgment, the next round is going to be in a federal district court, probably in Dallas or in Washington. That's the next round here.
But your position was that the resolution did not prohibit Syntex from paying the fee, but that the consent decree could not have issued without the resolution. And it seems to me the issuance of the consent decree then indicates that the agency thought that this was covered by the resolution. rightly or wrongly.
Perhaps. I mean, I, if anything, to me, the consent decree seems to say, listen, we didn't get it right the first two times. We didn't get it right in the December 29th resolution. We obviously didn't get it right on the January 31st resolution, so let's try one more time with this consent decree. Let's don't mention to Mr. Dalton about it. Let's just do it. And, I mean, you know, once again, it's Brer Rabbit, don't throw me in the briar patch. You know, they're not protesting very much. The other point I wanted to...
having occurred, whether they didn't get it right the first two times, they've now got the consent decree there, why doesn't that make it impossible for them to perform?
Well, I would take this position. First off, the contract right had matured, and our right to collect against Centex was fixed, final, and done.
If they closed this deal.
If they closed the deal, which clearly they had a right under our contract not to do. They could have and rightly should have said to the board, wait a minute, if you're gonna crawfish on us like that, we made a contract with Mr. Dalton.
Is your case still a contract or is it a tort now?
Well, if it's a tort, I hope it's fraud because that would still give us another shot to come back before the four-year statute is up. So I don't know the answer to that, Chief Justice. I really don't.
Would you please address the other side's discussions relative to the forum, the jurisdictional question? They argued we have a federal preemption here. We have an impossibility of performance because of a federal prohibition on them complying with that part of the contract, and that the proper jurisdiction is not here anyway because under federal law he is the party aggrieved and he should be pursuing his remedy in federal forum.
It all comes down to the last thing you said, party aggrieved. And I guess in my mind, the way I see it is he's not a party aggrieved because, number one, the resolution as passed originally on December the 29th clearly didn't prohibit the payment. And I would say if for no other reason, fortunately for us, at least we got it nailed down that day. Because I don't think that I disagree with the concept that the federal government clearly, under the Della Cuesta case, under Hines versus Davidowitz, the Florida Avocado case, all those cases say the government can preempt this field, and this is a particularly regulated field. But it seems to me that they've got to do it right. And they didn't do it right, number one. Number two, if you read the cases they've cited, for example, the Haar case, there's actually two Haar cases. They've only cited the second opinion. The first opinion, you read a little bit of the facts and you find out that the parties that are the, quote, parties aggrieved were, in fact, served notice of the order in question. My client, there's no summary judgment record, evidence in this record that Mr. Dalton was ever given notice of any of these events. Certainly, he wasn't given notice of the OTS consent decree either. So, if he is a party aggrieved, are we just to toss due process out the window completely and say, again, the 900-pound gorilla makes the rules, and you don't even have a chance to go fight it? I mean, that's the effect of what they're arguing. Ha ha! You didn't find out in the 30 days.
I think that's a full answer to the question. Are there any other questions? Thank you, Kevin.
Let me briefly respond to your order to some of the questions that were raised earlier concerning the summary judgment record. I think it's important to go back and focus on the procedural posture of this case. When this case was filed, at the time of the summary judgment hearing, Centex had specifically pleaded the federal prohibition, cited the statute in connection with both its plea to the jurisdiction, and they pleaded that as an affirmative defense, and they'd also filed a plea in abatement to the effect that the federal government was a necessary party to this dispute. The the critical fact that needed to be established in the summary judgment record before the district court in order to raise a fact issue on summary judgment was some evidence on Syntex's part that the federal government had in fact acted to make the prohibition against the payment. And it was not Syntex's burden at that time to prove every federal statute that was applicable. And that seems to me to be an important point here, because the consent decree, the resolution itself, and the minute entry, those are federal law that the court is required to take notice of. We specifically invoked federal law in our affirmative defense, and then the question, having done that, the question is, or the duty of the court is to ascertain and then apply federal law. Mr. Quinn's affidavit by itself, without the attachment of either the minute entry or the transcript of the December 28th telephone meeting, establishes the fact of that the federal government had acted to impose this prohibition. Then the question is, under federal law, what authority did they have to do it, and what is the effect of that exercise of authority on Syntex's obligations under federal law and under state law to Mr. Dalton?
Is there any requirement of notice to Mr. Dalton? You say he's the aggrieved party. Normally an aggrieved party has to be given some kind of notice when his interests are at stake.
Well, I don't know what
he was a part of the contract that they were passing on. The prohibition affects him directly and him exclusively as far as any deprivation of benefit is concerned. You concede that he had performed everything he could and was called upon to perform up to that point.
Up until that time, that's correct.
Were it not for this prohibition, you concede that you would have owed him, I think, about $300,000 at that point.
That's correct.
So was he entitled to any kind of notice? Did he get any kind of notice, or does due process require any kind of notice?
The record, of course, simply doesn't reflect whether he got any notice or not. The record doesn't reflect what notice the agency is required to give and to whom under the federal statutes of the action that it takes. But it seems to me that that is an issue. If he's entitled to notice and didn't receive the proper notice that the agency was required to give him, then that impacts his ability to now come in or to come in at whatever point in time learns of the adverse agency action and pursue his remedy through the federal administrative process. There's no federal requirement that Syntex give any notice to Mr. Dalton of the agency's action that I'm aware of, or that he has cited in his brief and claimed that we didn't comply with.
Well, good faith, I can't think of one.
And I think there's certainly no claim in this record that Syntex hid this from Mr. Dalton, or that he didn't become aware of it at a reasonable point in time after the prohibition was entered. The other point I'd like to make is that it seems to me that it is clear, just unquestionably clear on the record, that the agency took action and intended, they interpreted the prohibition that they included in the resolution that was issued on December 29 as prohibiting this specific payment. The minute entry, the decision to make the minute entry was made at the same time. And that's not a change that occurs on January 31, but in some sense it's irrelevant. Because the question is whether now there exists a federal prohibition established pursuant to the federal government's exercise of its regulatory authority that prohibits Syntex from making this payment, and it's undisputed on this record that there is.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in this clause. The foregoing causes of submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now adjourn the court for the day.
The audience will please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.